Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice Alvey, not David Lickin. David cannot be with us this week as he has a family emergency, and our thoughts are with Dave today. So it will be me filling in for Dave, hopefully being able to keep the show running just as smoothly as he does here. Our special guests today are Andy Schell. Andy Schell is going to be with us from Mortgage Banking Solutions, helping us with all types of accounting information and helpful tips for those of us who really need to make sure we're running our shops well. We are going to have our regular segments with Joe Farr. And also later in the program, we'll have Glenn Corso joining us. Glenn will be giving us an update, the latest and greatest information on the homebuyer tax credit situation right now, as we're all anxiously waiting to hear what's going to be happening with the possible extension. So without further ado, I want to get started with our first segment on interest rates with Joe Farr. Joe, welcome to the program.
Alice.
Happy Monday.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to hearing that, especially about the home buyer tax credit extension. That's got to be creating a lot of operational nightmares for people right now, and it sounds like there's a little bit of a nightmare going on up there because a lot of wrangling going on with the bill that's part of. But anyway, I'll be anxious to hear what Glenn has to say. Hey, today. We started out, Alice, this has been a wild day so far already. We started out this morning dropping pretty significantly in mortgage-backed security prices. We fell down to about 10, 30 seconds lower than where we ended the day on Friday. And it seemed to be kind of a knee-jerk reaction to what China did over the weekend. They announced that they were going to begin to let their currency float with the market, and expectations are that as they do that their currency will rise as compared to the dollar, and with that their consumers will be more able to purchase U.S. goods, and that's good for business in the U.S. Actually, worldwide stock markets reacted in an opposite direction favorably based on the news this morning, and that the stock market started out about 150 points above where it ended Friday. Mortgage-backed security prices started the day, most of the morning, in fact, down about 10, 30 seconds, as I said, but they're currently up from where they ended Friday. We're about 12, 30 seconds higher than this morning. And as a result, we have seen some favorable price changes occur from investors that put their prices out between 9 and 10:30 or so in the morning. So, been a volatile session.
Okay. Well, and it sounds like people are reacting just to China just mentioning that, or saying that they're going to make this move. They haven't actually done it yet. Is that correct?
They haven't done it, and I think that's part of why we're back up. I mean, the initial reaction was sort of, that's a good thing, going to be a good thing for stocks, and people kind of shifted their assets. Recently, we've just seen a lot of trading based on headlines, and the first reaction is let's go for it, and it seems to be that anything good for the economy is causing people to jump into the stocks, and as they jump into the stocks, you're getting out of the bonds, including mortgage-backed securities. So we see an exaggerated reaction, and that's kind of what happened this morning. Now we're stocks are still up a little bit, but bonds have fully recovered their morning loss.
Well, so what happened last week? Give us a little summary of what happened last week then.
Well, last week was a week unlike the probably three or four or five others prior to it that wasn't driven by what's going on in Europe. What we saw last week was a reaction, I think, to the very favorable inflationary numbers that came out. Both CPI and PPI came out very low, with very low inflation, 1.9% annual rate of inflation on the core CPI That's I'm sorry, not 1.9, 0.9.
Oh,
and that's
say, yeah.
That,
okay.
Yeah, that's as low as it's been in like 40 years. So,
wow.
You know, inflation is the factor that the Fed's trying to fight right now. There's some concern about it being too low as opposed to being too high. But as inflation goes up, or the risk of future inflation goes up, investors tend to push long-term interest rate yields higher. And what we're seeing right now is there's just no inflationary pressure to do that right now and for I don't know how long. But, core CPI was well under level of concern, as was core PPI.
It seems like we're doing okay as of for now, right? For things to hold steady.
It has, just like this morning was volatile, so was last week. We saw, Alice, four of the 5 days last week, there were midday price changes, which is a sign that market's moving around a lot. Two of which were favorable. There was one day where there were like three different favorable price changes. That was the day that CPI came out. We had about a 15-30 second improvement in prices that day. But a couple of days were unfavorable too. So it's just a volatile time, and people are reacting to pretty much anything and everything, and sometimes they're kind of overreacting, and then cooler heads prevail. But very volatile time.
Well, so we'll have to. What do we have to look forward to this week then, with all that volatility?
Well, I don't. We're starting out the week certainly with a volatile day. The Fed meeting next week. This week's the big thing, Alice. It's the Fed meets tomorrow and Wednesday. They'll come out Wednesday at 2:15 Eastern time, or thereabouts, with a statement. Quite frankly, there's very little expectation for a change in what's said in that statement. Certainly no change to the Fed funds rate, but even their statement is unlikely to change a whole lot, and I think that that's what the market's kind of expecting. So, if they were to make some unexpected statement, we'd see a reaction in the marketplace. But, so let's kind of hope that the Fed just holds on where they are and kind of waits to see.
Okay.
Next week, though, we also see the home sales numbers. The existing home sales comes out tomorrow, and the new home sales comes out on Wednesday. Since they're for activity in May, we should see pretty good months because it's still, that's part of closing all those April contracts to get the home buyer tax credit.
Yeah, are they're going by contracts or closings on those numbers?
Those are closings.
Yeah.
Those are closings. So it's actual sales. The durable orders number comes out on Thursday. It's sometimes a big number, but it's usually fairly volatile. We do have Treasury auctions this week on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They're the 2, 5, and 7 year Treasuries, so they I wouldn't expect them to be overly concerning for the mortgage market. Maybe if you get to the 5 and 7 years and it's a very poor auction, you might see some reaction. But so far for today, things have made a big improvement, and I hope you've seen those favorable price changes.
All right. So we'll just get ready for keeping things steady for our customers right now in the interest rate environment as best we can. We'll watch for that. And, of course, using MBS Quoteline to keep on top of those daily rate changes. So up next, I'm going to be giving you the legislative update. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteline delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Hi, everyone. This is Alice Alvey. I'm filling in for Dave here. And so now I know one of the segments you're anticipating always at this point in the show is trying to hear what's going on with the legislative update. And, right now we've been watching that financial regulatory reform stability bill for many, many months. It's still in committee. We don't have any final information out of that. Lots of discussions ensuing about different amendments and so forth, and really at this point it's just best and wait to see what's coming out on the other side of this after it gets out of committee. We'll be able to get into some more detail. I think overall, as an industry, the main pieces we're watching for are the risk retention, which as of now, it does look like it's going to be, yes, there will be a certain amount, as much as 5% of risk of capital that needs to be retained by lenders. It'll be, however, that loans that meet certain underwriting standards will be exempt from that provision. A lot of detail to define all that will have to come out after the law. So one of the things to keep in mind is we may end up with a bill that we understand at a very high level, but there'll be a lot of questions once the bill actually does have a final version. Even once signed by the president, there'll be many things that have to then be implemented through policies and rulemaking by the different agencies that'll be accountable for different parts of it. So we're really in right now in a wait-and-see mode for Senate Bill 3217, Restoring American Financial Stability.
Hey, Alice?
Also, yes.
Joe. I was just gonna add in there the conference committee has begun their markup on a bill that seems more similar to the Senate, especially as it relates to that risk retention provision, which I think is very fortunate, because the Senate is the side that passed the amendment to that to the House version that said qualified loans will be exempted. So it's
right.
a good thing they're starting there.
Yes, especially thanks to a lot of the discussion that Glenn Corso's group was working with the Community Mortgage Banking Project. The industry, I think, got the message out as to what would be happening if there was no exclusion for loans with reasonable quality, reasonable underwriting standards. So we'll all be watching that very closely. We'll definitely, as we get some more definition, more information on that, be covering that also on future shows. The other bills we're watching, H.R. 5072, this is the FHA reform. Now, it officially passed the House back on June 10th. This is the bill that would be increasing the annual premium. So as of now, the HUD secretary could go up to 1.55. They've announced different numbers over the months. Previous months on what they may select. They may not go all the way up to 1.55, but the bill gives them authority to do so. So there's a lot in here that will change HUD's authority, and so now we have to wait to see what kind of a Senate version we will get to look at FHA reform. So this is the House Bill 5072 that we'll be watching. Now we've had also requests. We have to make sure we get rural development in there. So we have a couple of bills that address the funding for RD. We've got House Bill 5017 passed the House. There's a Senate Bill 3266 that's pending. These two bills have identical verbiage, virtually identical, to have the rural development guarantee fee changed up to 4%, but it also allocates over $30 billion in funding. Right now, where we stand with the RD program is just simply that they have authority to issue conditional commitments, but and a lender technically can take an application and can actually close a loan, but you can't get funding out of RD. Right now, they have authority to issue up to $2.5 billion in actual approvals, but the lender is assuming all the loss default risk for the loan until funds are available from RD. Then there's another bill as well. There's a House Bill 4899 that's also trying to address changing the guarantee fee. So as of now, we have nothing concrete on RD for additional funds, and we'll be watching that closely for you.
Hey, all right. Alice.
Yes.
I just wanted to pitch in here that the change to the FHA insurance premiums, I was talking to some of our MI friends, and it sure seems as though it's going to be a nice little shift in movement from what have been FHA loans to maybe conventional conforming. If you have, if that FHA insurance goes up, it could be that there's a nice little shift toward the conventional with MI.
Yeah, I think there'll certainly be some of those better credit score customers that are ending up FHA, not because of credit, but because, you know, simply when you balance the numbers between MIP and PMI, in some cases, you know, the FHA is coming out just slightly more affordable, or, you know, maybe close enough that they may lean FHA, whereas, you know, in the old days, everybody went PMI instead of FHA. So, yeah, I think the PMI companies will be happy about that.
Kind of come full circle here.
Right, right. Well, I don't know if they'll go quite as low credit score as FHA will. So, you know, some of those questions the PMI companies have asked us is, how come FHA is getting these 700 credit scores? So, yeah, I think they'll be happy to get some of that good credit back on their plate. So we'll watch and see what the actual numbers come out once FHA actually settles on what would be the new upfront premium and what would be the annual premium that they decide to move forward with. So the bill just is simply giving them authority. We'll wait and see after the bills are finalized what potentially may be out there in actual loan level, once we actually have the product available. So as of now, it's just bills running through the House. And like I said, we're waiting for the other side of it from the Senate. We're also watching, just as, to give everyone a heads up, I know that Reg Z has been a stress point as well for loan officer compensation. That comment period closed at the end of the year. We talked a lot about that in previous shows, but I want everyone to know that it's still pending. We don't see that Reg Z is going, that they're going to be able to address all the parts of the changes in Reg Z until we see what happens in financial regulatory reform. And so once that moves forward, we think then we'll be able to move forward with, or the Fed will start moving forward with Reg Z. Loan officer compensation is a part of that. It was Reg Z changes, the proposed rule that was going to prohibit compensation to loan officers based on the terms of the loan. If the financial regulatory reform bill addresses a part of that, which is still a wait and see, then we may end up with that Reg Z doesn't add to that. So some of the other bills that we're watching are really watching for any extension of VA home loan benefits to children of veterans. And really, that's the main piece. And watching HUD's advance notice of proposed rulemaking to see what is going to come out of the new definition for required use. HUD still has to resolve that within the RESPA 2010 ruling. So, and Joe, anything else I need to have on the plate here for legislative update?
No, I think, you know, the big thing's coming up, obviously, and that financial reform is going to be, Glenn can give us an update on sort of when he expects things to happen. At one point, they were talking about that being signed by the president by July 4th, and I just don't know if they're far enough along to do that, or maybe they are. Be interesting to hear.
Yeah, it would. All right, well, we'll make sure we keep our radar on that. So coming up in our next segment, we're going to have Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions. Also later in the program, we're going to have a quick update from Rob Katz, and we're going to be talking about Fannie Mae's announcement on title defects. So we have a lot coming up in the show. Please stay tuned.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals,
providing classroom and web-based delivery,
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record, performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees, both live and online, on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lincoln on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's David Lincoln.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice. As I mentioned before, I'm in for Dave. Dave will be back next week. I want to let you know that our next guest today is Andy Schell. Andy is here to talk to us about driving profitability. Andy is all about return on investment. I hear him often comment on what is the ROI on that. I think he said that when we went out to dinner one time. It is like he walks around measuring profitability on everything. He's been in financial management for over 30 years, where his focus has been on how to make more profit. He has been in the position of COO and CFO for many companies, where he's directed operational and profit enhancement efforts. He worked for B of A in San Francisco, and his team launched correspondent lending in 1993. Just an absolute tremendous combination of a background in accounting and hands-on mortgage banking. On top of that, Andy's a CPA, he's a certified mortgage banker, and he also holds a certification in financial forensics. Just hearing that just scares me, Andy. That just sounds very complicated. It means he's good at solving financial mysteries, right? So that sounds like the CSI of the financial side. He earned both an undergraduate and graduate degree in financial management. He's a published author on topics including capital markets, risk management, and profit enhancement. He started his consulting company known as CFO to Go and the Profit Doctor. Then in 2007, he joined David Licken and Chuck Klein to form Mortgage Banking Solutions, where he is a managing partner, and he directs CFO to Go, which is a great service. You guys need to check that out at the MBS website. And he also covers the capital markets area of the firm. So, Andy, it's wonderful to have you on the show today talking about driving profitability. So tell everybody, what is the Profit Doctor?
Well, thanks, Alice. Boy, it's such a delight to be on the show and to talk to you again live this time instead of at dinner. Live on the radio.
That's
well,
right.
The Profit Doctor, that came from thinking about how we view a doctor. You know, when we look at our own health, how do we maintain a healthy lifestyle? Well, we exercise, we eat well, and even when we do all the right things, we still might get sick or might get hit with a truck, but still we exercise and we eat well, and this is the most important part. We measure our health, and we need to also measure our businesses. So how do we measure our health? Well, we take our blood pressure and our temperature and our weight and our cholesterol, and we do all these things, and we do what we think are the right things, and we measure our progress to make sure our health is right. So when we're sick, we go to the doctor, and we get diagnosis. He does a bunch of tests and MRIs and stuff to figure out what's wrong with us, and then prescribes a path to health. Well, when the doctor tells us that we need to, you know, eat less red meat or exercise more or lose weight or whatever it is, we do what they say because we know that we'll get better. And the same thing applies for a business. There are ways to get better in business. So the Profit Doctor, we diagnose earning issues and we figure out how to increase profits. And sometimes when businesses aren't making as much money as they'd like, people are starting to call that leakage, leaking profits. And you know, it
sounds better in a financial sense than it does from a body, you know. At least that doctor's not talking about leakage.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever walked into an appointment and had that.
Doctor, I'm leaking.
Well, you know, you think about it like oil. Think about it out of your car. You know, if you've got a leak in your car, it can be really hard to diagnose, but it's important to find it because bad things could happen.
Well, and you usually find out things are leaking when times are really tough, you know. But I think people can have leaks even when times are going smoothly and going well.
They can, and not even realize it because they'd be a little bitty drip. And sometimes we've seen companies that are leaking like the oil in the Gulf of Mexico. So that's really bad, and we see that here in Austin, that it's affecting a lot of people. So it's important to pay attention to little leaks and big leaks and make it fixed because it's all about making profits.
So is success in business random? I mean, is it, you know, what is the formula for success then in trying to plug these, be healthy? How's the Profit Doctor going to come up with a success formula for mortgage companies?
Well, if we think about it just like we do in in our body, in health, we know there's a formula for health. And it is true then there's also a path to success in business, and it's not random, and there's reasons why businesses are successful, and owners and managers have a significant influence over the success in their business. I mean, that's why. that's real quick point here, Alice. That's why Fortune 1000 companies have MBAs running around that are trained to drive profitability, because they know the path to financial success.
So what's the formula?
Well, there's several elements to it. There you go. And it starts with financial success means having more money, more revenue coming in, more money coming in than money going out. So when you have more revenue, you have less expense, and you have profit. So that's good. We want to have more profit. But it's sometimes hard to identify exactly where that comes from. There's a bunch of other elements that come into that. It's not just the numbers. The numbers tell us the story, but our actions and our behavior and how we manage our business is what drives the numbers. We have to do things in our business to generate revenue. We have to do things in our business to control expenses so that we end up with profit. And really, at the bottom line, it's operational discipline and an unwavering focus to drive profitability that makes a company successful. At the actual legal name of the business that I started, went by the name of the Profit Doctor, was called Defying Gravity. And one of the logos was a little drop of water coming out of a pond. And the reason that was the logo is that took force. It took energy. It took effort for that drop of water to be suspended in the air, to defy gravity, like a dog jumping to catch a frisbee. That kind of effort is what organizations have to do every day in order to be successful. You have to have organizational discipline and an unwavering focus to get to drive profitability.
So what are the you talk about E3 and R3. Tell us about the business principles for success.
Well, this is a couple of things that I've summarized and things that I've noticed over my career, and there's really there's three E words: efficient, effective, and economic. So if something's efficient, it means that it's moving quickly, it's not wasting any time. And if something's effective, it means that it's producing the correct result. And then economic means that you're making money at it. The revenue that it generates is more than the cost that it incurs. So you got to balance it, though, because you have to balance effective with efficient. And it really comes down to, it's summertime in Texas, and there's a crepe myrtle tree right outside my office window, and I've had an allergic reaction going on here. To make the point on effective and efficient, you've got to do it right the first time. Because if you're so efficient that you go so fast that you make mistakes, then you got to do it over again. And if you've got to do it over again, you might as well have just slowed down a little bit and do it right the first time.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it. So you want to do it right the first time. And if you're going so fast that you're missing stuff, like a process fog is an underwriting and a bunch of stuff's missed, well, then that means they went too fast, probably. So they got to slow down, because it's better to do it right. It's better to do it right the first time than to do it twice.
Have you ever tried to slow down sales? I can't ever slow down the sales department. It's always, in any of the efficiency reviews we've gone in to do, it's always, no, everybody else has to figure out how to let sales work at the pace it's working at. And, you know, operationally, I think it's very difficult, like you said, to have it efficient and effective when you're still trying to close loans, and especially with the chaos people have going on right now with the home buyer tax credit.
Well, I can tell you that if sales is driving the ship and sales is focusing only on volume, that organizations that do that consistently end up with mistakes and errors and costs. You have to balance it. You really have to balance it. Do it right the first time. Manage the metrics. And if you need to add more staff, then do that. We'll talk about that. But the mantra has to be operational discipline, unwavering focus, do it right the first time. And you do that with the three R's, and that is having the right people doing the right things at the right time. So you're going to be efficient, effective, and economic, and you're going to have the right people doing the right things at the right time. And it takes all of that working together to drive profitability. You just can't – it's not random. It takes a formula, and then it takes a process.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about that process management and capacity management that you can help people with.
Well, if you think about it, well, what's a mortgage bank? A mortgage bank is really a loan factory. And the goal of the loan factory is to move loans as quickly through the process as possible so that they become a loan and get purchased by the investor. And we want to do this with as few people as possible touching the file, and we want to accomplish this every time with no errors.
Wow. Has that ever been done? Sorry. I want to see that shop.
You know, what's amazing is that if you look at the really big organizations, they bring in people that are called Six Sigma, Six Sigma Black.
Yep.
And they drill down, and Six Sigma is the sixth standard deviation, which basically means the error rate is 0.000001, whatever. So the error rate's very, very low, so these big organizations run very, very efficiently because they do these things. They run the three E's, they run the three R's, efficient, effective, economic, right people, right things, right time. And by doing that, you end up with correct loans that get purchased the first time with very few errors. Now,
Andy, it sounds to me like what you're describing, we got away from. You know, the industry as a whole got away from it, and kind of in 05, 06, 07, as things were just going crazy.
Yeah, you know, you're right, Joe. It kind of takes me back to when I started in lending in 1980 at a savings loan, and that pace was probably a little bit too slow. But I think we've gone too far the other way, and we need to focus on doing the right things and doing it right the first time. Because here's a couple of quick examples. There are a number of efficiency impacts that a mortgage banker can look at. And for example, how many warehouse lines are enough? Well, we know more than one is important, and you need to have two. So do you need three? Well, do you need seven? And how many investors are enough? You know, probably two, three niche products, maybe four, but what about 7, 8, 12? And you know, another one is how many commission plans are enough? And these all are fuzzy, and they all add soft costs that are difficult to detect. And they create inefficiency that creates the leakage. Because every time you add a new warehouse line, your funding people have to figure out how to manage it and how to deal with all the issues and how to request the money, and you're going to have new bank accounts that have to be reconciled. And for every new investor, there's a new stacking order and new underwriting standards and new delivery requirements. And, oh, by the way, don't confuse one investor's guidelines with another investor guideline. Close it under the wrong guideline, and guess what you got?
Yeah, and
you know?
I think you bring up such a huge point on the soft cost, because we see that. You know, we'll go in with operational reviews, and senior management might think, oh, it's a piece of cake. We've implemented a new investor before. We can handle that. But like you said, what's the right number for this shop? Is adding that investor for one or two loans you might close periodically really worth all the soft costs?
Yeah, exactly. And so one other quick point is on the commission plans. We've seen commission plans taken to a ridiculous extreme where each originator has a unique plan that resets with each new volume target, and this takes time and money and process to correctly implement, and it increases the probability for error. So really, think about administrative impact when you make decisions, because there always will be administrative impacts for changes in the flow of the business. And we have seen this point, the soft cost, the unidentified soft cost, is one of the most significant contributors to leakage in a mortgage bank that drives inefficiencies. So, again,
Like Congress is going to help us out here. They're going to pass a law so that we're all paying the same, one commission.
Well, we might have different ways of getting there, right? So, all right. Well, it's just great information. I have to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with more from Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success. Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit, broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging, financial and accounting services, or meeting your capitalization needs. If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact our Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave. We'll be, in a short bit, we're going to be talking with Glenn Corso from the Community Mortgage Banking Project about the Home Buyer Tax Credit. Right now, we're speaking with Andy Schell from Mortgage Banking Solutions. And, Andy, I know we've got so many things that you have information on that we want to share with people. We may end up having to bring you back several times to cover all these this wonderful information on the accounting side here for this this topic. And I know the next thing we wanted to make sure we help people with was what the foundation in the finance is. So let's talk a little bit about. I know I teased you about ROI, so maybe we better talk about that for a minute.
Alrighty. Yes, absolutely. Well, ROI means return on investment, and there's all kinds of different ways that this gets calculated, and there's some very advanced concepts in ROI, and it's called economic profit and economic value added and a bunch of other stuff. But the bottom line of it is, with ROI, return on investment, you need to make certain that every expense is tied to a revenue-generating activity that produces more revenue than the expense. And that's what that means, that taking this into your business, if you're going to go buy a big stack of file folders for your business, you need to think, you know, how is this file folder stack going to increase my business profit? How am I going to generate revenue with this? Or attending conferences and trade shows and anything you're going to do, you think about, okay, the reason I'm doing this is because, and then you answer the question, I'm going to generate additional revenue because I'm going to talk to this person and that person or whatever it is, but they all need to be tied back to dollars.
Now, can it be that simple to get, you know, how many loans do I have in process? And therefore I must, or how many applications am I taking? And I find most people manage, most lenders anyway, mortgage lenders, to have a tendency to manage that way, just by headcount with number of units.
Well, and if that's the only thing that they look at, then there may be some expenses that are being dispersed that are unnecessary, because you got to include the expense equation into the whole discussion. Like, for example, there was one client that we were looking at that the one branch decided they were going to buy everybody 35-inch Apple monitors. So they spent $5,000 to buy five monitors. And you think about, okay, what's the ROI on that? What was the alternative to that? What was the opportunity cost lost? Because they could have bought, you know, 23-inch monitors for $200 or $300. So it's being smart about it. It's thinking about it first and then being smart about it. And you have to assess this in everything that you do. And it gets fuzzy. There's no question about it. If Dave were here, he and I go round and round on this point often, especially when it comes to marketing. You've got to spend money to make money. And you don't want the accounting people saying, you can't spend, you can't spend, you can't spend. What the accounting people need to say is, spend on things that generate revenue, spend money on things that generate revenue, and generate enough revenue to pay back the expense you just spent. That's what accounting needs to say. And in included in the foundation in finance, there's several principles I want to hit on pretty quick, and I realize we're running longer. And that is a risk versus return, RVR I call it, risk versus return. It's applied to everything. And what it means is if the risk that you incur will drive the return that you receive. You put money in a CD at a bank, you might get 2%, and so that's your return. So, but it's very low risk. Chances of losing your money are very, very thin. Invest in the stock market, higher risk, higher return, higher risk. And everything you do, there's a risk return. Adding a new branch, risk return, ROI. You have to consider all of those things. Right now, people are out trying to add branches so fast that they need to remember the three R's, right people, right people doing the right things at the right time. I see people adding branches just because they can fog the mirror. You know, we used the fog the mirror test on subprime borrowers, you know, 4 years ago, and look what happened with that.
If you don't have the right mix, that can be just such a disaster, in trying to blend cultures and blend operations. So, you know, to your point, just adding a branch doesn't necessarily mean you're adding profit.
No, exactly. And there's a path that it probably can, but the automatic assumption is that more volume equal more profit. Well, maybe, and possibly, and maybe even probably, but only if you apply the principles that drive the revenue and control the expenses. Another quick important principle in finance is present value. Present value basically means that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow, and you need to remember that cash is king. And one of the last points on financial principles, so we got ROI, risk versus return, present value, and forecasting. Financial forecasting is an essential element. Financial forecasting is like being the sniper. So you're a sniper working for the Army, and you've got a target. Well, you're going to identify the target, you're going to confirm the range, you're going to calibrate for the wind, you're going to confirm the target, you're going to shoot, and then you're going to measure your result. So that's like six steps or whatever. What a lot of people do in business is it's shoot, ready, aim. Whoops, sorry,
right.
I shot the wrong guy.
We invented that in mortgage banking, I think.
I think we did too. I think we very much did. And we've got to slow down and be the sniper. Don't just gunslinger, shoot, ready, aim. That will almost always be wrong. If you'll be the sniper, your probability of doing it right increases magnitudes of time. So it's all about profit. We've got to be focusing on making more profit.
Well, it's also, it takes so much analysis, you know, I think, and how do you say, how does it apply to a mortgage bank? You know, we've just got a couple more minutes here, and I want to make sure we zero in on some of the key points you want to make sure that people have as a takeaway. So, you know, taking all this, how does this apply to a mortgage bank?
Well, we just talked about adding a branch. So adding a branch could mean more volume, probably means more volume, but it's got to mean more profit. So are you sure you could be increasing cost? Do you have enough warehouse line capacity to manage it? A quick side note about adding branch and volume, if you're a mortgage banker and you're funding loans and you're growing your business and most of the warehouse line lenders are going to require that you're putting a little bit of your own money in each loan that's getting funded, so that means your cash is going into this pile of funded loans that as soon as they're purchased by the investor, you get your money back and all your profit. Well, what happens if you're growing real fast and your volumes are increasing and you've got a bunch of loans funded and whoops, we got payroll on month end? All it takes is one owie, one missed payroll, and you're done. And that can happen because you're growing too fast and you didn't forecast your cash flow and you are in a real bad way. Adding branches can also affect your pull-through. It'll affect your hedging position. It can affect your technology license, your technology integration. I mean, it goes on and on.
It can affect relationships, investor relationships. So it's, you know, it really affects everything that you touch. And I don't think people realize. I think they think it is more of adding just good things and we'll figure out the challenges later. And there's just so much to analyze.
Exactly.
Andy, we obviously don't know much about what went on at Taylor, Bean, and Whitaker, but it's interesting that you brought that up about missing a payroll and, you know, planning for production and growth. I mean, those are all the kinds of things that you read about as being part of the start of the problem.
Joe. Let me end with this one real quick point, and it relates to what you just said about TB&W and Lee Farkas. Financial statements are complicated. Financial statements are difficult to understand. It takes specialized skills to be able to prepare good financial statements for a mortgage bank. There's not just any bookkeeper can do it. They need to be good at mortgage banking. One thing every owner needs to realize, every quarter, every month, depending on which warehouse line lender you're dealing with, you're going to have to give them a certificate along with your financial statements that you're going to sign, and you're going to say, these financial statements are right. Well, what if they're not right? And how do you know that they're right? Because if you give a federally insured depository, which is what your warehouse line lender is, a financial statement that's wrong and you've signed representing that it's correct, it's a federal offense. You just misrepresented data to a financial institution. It's also called loan fraud. And Lee Farkas is in jail because of it.
Well, and you just think how many people became owners of mortgage lenders because they were good at sales and, you know, not necessarily that they had an accounting background. So how many of them just trust the individual that they've given their paperwork to, you know, or found an affordable accounting person as opposed to the right accounting person, as you said earlier?
Yes. Well, hopefully in wrapping this up for this segment, what I hope the people listening walk away from is business owners, business managers need to find empowerment, and that empowerment comes from implementing sound business strategies and business philosophies, the three E's, the three R's, financial forecasting, good financial statements, good metrics, managing efficiency and driving profitability through your business, because that empowerment with data gives you the ability to implement change, and as you impact change within your organization, that will ultimately drive profitability.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. I'm motivated to go look at my financials now.
Well, good.
And so we have Glenn Corso on the line. He is waiting to give us an update on the home buyer tax credit, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back after this brief word.
PMI Mortgage Insurance Company is the clear choice for your higher LTV conventional borrowers. Unlike FHA, PMI offers a choice of flexible premium plans to fit the individual needs of each borrower. From a one-time upfront cost with no renewal premium to a monthly plan with no upfront charges, PMI's premium plans recognize larger down payment and good credit history, saving your clients what can at times be thousands of dollars. PMI also provides lenders with fast electronic submission tools to increase efficiencies. Mortgage insurance is more relevant than ever, so it's important to utilize a mortgage insurer who's committed to the business for the long term. It is vital that you work with a company whose core competency is credit risk management and bring that wealth of knowledge to your firm. At PMI, mortgage insurance is their only business, so they have to get it right. PMI's mission is to create sustainable homeownership opportunities. To learn more about how PMI solutions can assist your business, please contact your PMI representative today or call 800-966-4PMI, 800-966-4PMI.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Alice Alvey. I wanted to let you know that shows and information like Andy provides sometimes is so valuable. You say, you know, I have other people in my organization. I want to be able to hear that because maybe you're not the person who runs the financials or makes financial decisions. But please keep in mind, the shows are recorded. We also have been able to go in and put in a summary of previous shows. So maybe you've been to the Blog Talk site in the past and just saw dates. Well, that's been changed over the last week. The site's had some improvements where now you can see some summaries of what's been on previous shows. So certainly go back and listen to get some more details and share it with others. Dave, this show is dedicated to bringing you important key information about the mortgage industry. I'd like to welcome Glenn Corso of the Community Mortgage Banking Project. Glenn, thank you so much for being here at such short notice to tell us what is the latest update on the home buyer tax credit extension, or really the extension for the closings, right?
Right, exactly right, Alice. Here's where things stand. This is kind of a typical good news, bad news sort of scenario. Senator Harry Reid, who's the Senate Majority Leader, last week added a provision to extend the closing date to qualify for the tax credit from June 30th to September 30th of this year. So it doesn't affect the tax credit per se. In other words, if you don't have it under contract already, this isn't going to help you. But what it does do is give you several more months to actually get the loan closed. What Senator Reid did, and this is the good news, is that he added that provision to a tax bill that the Senate is considering right now. The bad news part of that is that the tax bill contains a number of tax provisions that are relatively non-controversial, but an extension of unemployment compensation benefits was also added to that bill in the Senate last week, and that's created a big firestorm of controversy between the people who don't feel that deficits are a big problem right now versus the folks who are very upset about the current level of deficits and don't want to do any more spending than is absolutely necessary. So there's kind of a big fight going on in the Senate about that. It has nothing to do with the extension date for the loan closings for the tax credit, but it has everything to do with a debate about where the country is going on a fiscal basis. So what we're hoping is that eventually that bill, which contains many other tax credits that need to be extended and are routinely extended every year, that that bill will be enacted. The thing I can't tell you is whether that's going to happen before June 30th or not. There's a real possibility that it may not. I hope that isn't the case, but I think you need to be prepared for that. In which case, then, we would expect that the Congress would kind of backdate things and say, okay, let's go back to June 30th, and as long as you qualified for the tax credit, even if you weren't able to close the loan by June 30, as long as you're able to close it by September 30, you'll be okay. So what I'm telling people is stay tuned, keep watching for what happens, and if June 30th comes and the legislation still hasn't been enacted, don't throw those loans into the trash yet, because they still may be okay.
Well, it's
hey,
not
Glenn?
Just about the loans. I mean, I just can't. What am I doing if I'm a seller, right? It's my house that's under contract, and now this
right.
expires, and my buyer is on that program. Do I have to sit around and cross my fingers that it's extended? And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people's lives that are impacted by this thing getting delayed.
Yeah, no, Alice, you're absolutely right. And the only thing I can tell you is that if there is any way under the sun that you can get the loan closed on or before June 30, I would move heaven and earth to do that rather than hope and pray that Congress not only will pass it, but do the right thing and backdate it. I think they will, but of course my saying that doesn't mean
yeah.
that it's actually going to happen that way.
Glenn, this is Joe. Is there any chance that we're going to hear something this week? I mean, after this week, it's kind of like all those 60 and 70-hour weeks that people are putting in right now. You know, you hope that they've closed all that they can. But, you know, there's still a lot of anxiety out there as far as will I close by June 30th and will I get my tax credit? So is there
right.
any chance at all that
right.
we'll hear something this week?
Joe, there absolutely is in the sense that, as you know, politics, you know, politics has a way of turning around on a dime. So what happened last week was that they needed 60 votes to cut off debate on this bill and move it to a vote. This is the larger bill I was talking about, that the tax credit extension, closing date extension was added to. They only got 56 votes. So that was held on Thursday. Now, as we've seen in the past, you know, a new week and all of a sudden a few senators change their mind and bang, you have the 60 votes. So it could absolutely happen, but there's no guarantee that it will. And it could happen this week.
And if the Senate passes this, I assume that then there's a need for the House to pass something like it and then put it to the president. So, you know, I guess all that kind of means, you know, what's the quickest time? Can that happen in a matter of days?
That can happen in a matter of days. The House actually has already taken their action. The House took their action several months ago.
Right.
Of course,
but
the
it
House
didn't
action
have this amendment.
Didn't include the extension. That's right.
Yeah.
And as nearly as I can tell from talking to a bunch of people, the extension of the loan closing date is not particularly controversial. In other words,
right.
this is something that everybody thinks, oh, yeah, okay, this makes sense to give people a little bit of extra time to get their affairs squared away. And since the date has already come and gone for actually putting the property under contract, this is simply extending the loan closing date. So that's not controversial. But of course, the other matters that I mentioned in there are I think that the House and Senate conference to iron out the differences would be relatively quick. So really the key is when does the Senate act? If the Senate acts this week, I think that they can get the differences ironed out pretty quickly and get the bill to the president in short order. So the key is going to be when does the Senate move ahead.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that update, Glenn. I think I do want to let people know also, wasn't there an active military piece in the original legislation? So if you were active military, you actually could had until April of 2011 to sign a contract. Is that correct, Glenn? Are you familiar with that provision?
You know, Alice, I'm sorry. I really haven't paid much attention to the active military piece.
Oh, okay.
My apologies on that one.
Oh, sorry for springing that on you. I should have prepared, but I'm
no,
going to
no,
follow up and check
okay.
in on that one.
Okay.
So, there's the one group that might be okay. So, but as of now, the National Association of Realtors are putting out some pretty big numbers of people who are impacted by this for the end of, you know, upwards of 75,000 loans. Is that correct? Trying to close before the month end?
Yeah, oh yes, and I don't have to tell you or anybody else in the industry that it's causing all kinds of headaches. We're hearing a lot from our members about that as well, as they're struggling to get things done on or before the 30th, because of course they can't assume that Congress is going to extend this loan closing deadline.
Okay. All right. Well, Joe, do you have any more questions?
Yeah. Well, I was going to shift gears so quickly just to see if there's anything more about the financial reform legislation any quick updates on what might happen as it relates to the risk retention? Is it going to be more like the Senate than the House? And
oh, well, Joe, actually, that's a very timely question. The House, not more than an hour and a half ago, issued their offer to the Senate on risk retention, and not surprisingly, they want to strike the Landrieu Hagen-Isaacson Amendment that provides for an exemption for qualified mortgages. What they're offering instead is a blanket exemption for FHA-insured, VA-guaranteed, and USDA-guaranteed loans from risk retention.
But not Fannie,
not
Freddie kind of loans.
But not Fannie, Freddie kind of loans. That's
wow.
Right. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty tough because that places a huge burden on the conventional market then, gives a tremendous pricing advantage to FHA, VA, and USDA loans, especially FHA loans.
Oh, heck yeah.
That's, you know, and that makes it very tough to ever have a private market in this country.
Yeah. Oh, that one's got to go up for that's got to go up for discussion. Well, I have to cut off the conversation here, folks. It has been great having the update, but we have one last bit we need to make sure that we get on. We are going to have to save title defects for next week. Thank you so much, Glenn and Andy Schell, for being on the show. We've got our final word here, the update, the hot topics coming from Rob Katz. So I want to thank everyone, and Andy, take it away on Rob Katz.
Hey, great show, team, and thanks for having me on to share the news that I think every lender should be paying attention to. First off, there was so much concern about the market collapsing after the Fed pulled out of buying mortgage-backed securities, and although there's been some fluctuation in that market, it certainly didn't collapse. Diana Golubay wrote up a nice story in Housing Wire that outlines the findings from PMI's economists that the true impact of the Fed's move out of the MBS space is just about 20 bips. They point out that the drop in the spread really had more to do with a flight towards quality than the actions of the Fed, and a lot of people expected it to be much worse than that. So this is pretty good news. Also, Forbes ran a column by Mark Lolich that does a good job of laying out what happened over the past couple of years that crashed our market and explains why he thinks the pending Financial Reform Act doesn't go far enough to protect our industry from future problems. Frankly, this is one of the most complicated issues to understand, and Mark's explanation lays out the issue in an understandable terms. It's a good read. Finally, now that we're into June, Fannie Mae's new loan quality initiative mandates are effective. There are several good articles floating around that explain the impact of this on lenders and your borrowers. Attorney Richard Vetstein wrote a pretty straightforward explanation on the Boston.com blog. He touches on the fact that borrowers who apply for credit for other types of purchases between the time that they first apply for a mortgage and then when you're ready to close should run into delays as you kind of have to re-underwrite and investigate that loan. So if you aren't up to speed on LQI, and most importantly, informing your borrowers not to get additional credit after they've applied for a loan with you, you need to get there quickly. Hey, team, that's what I have for you this week. I'll be back next week with more news that everybody should know.
All right. Well, thank you, Rob Katz from PMI, and thanks, Glenn Corso. We definitely need to have Glenn back on and talk further about that pending legislation and what's going on with financial regulatory reform to see what's going to happen on the other end of that for the risk retention. More on that next week. Thank you all for being on the program. Thank you, Andy Schell, again, from Mortgage Banking Solutions. Take care, everyone.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. On the web at www.mortgagebankingsolutions.com. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, delivering live mortgage-backed security prices as trades happen, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U, your ultimate education and information resource. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.